From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The paddy wagon was right there. They took the young man out, beat him some more. The man wasn't responding. They took him by his pants, and he was dragged. Mm-hmm. And I asked them to call an ambulance. They told me to mind my business. I told them it is my business.
Mm-hmm.
And they just threw him up in there. They killed that young man.
Protests in Baltimore are entering their fifth day over the death of Freddie Gray, a 27-year-old African-American man who died Sunday from spinal injuries 1 week after Baltimore police arrested him. His family and attorney say his voice box was crushed and his spine 80% severed at his neck. The Department of Justice is now investigating his death. We'll go to Baltimore, where we'll be joined by Lawrence Bell, the former president of the Baltimore City Council, Eddie Conway, a former member of the Baltimore Black Panthers who spent more than four decades in jail, and Dominique Stevenson, a local activist who was arrested at a protest yesterday. Then to Yemen.
The objective of this new phase is to continue to protect the civilians in Yemen from takeover by the Houthis, to counter any aggressive moves by the Houthis in Yemen, and to work on enhancing the flow of humanitarian assistance to Yemen and ease the work of international humanitarian organizations in Yemen.
Is after Saudi Arabia declared an end to its military mission in Yemen, the Saudi-led coalition continues to bomb Yemeni cities. As the civilian death toll mounts, the International Committee of the Red Cross says the humanitarian situation in Yemen is catastrophic. We'll speak with Saudi expert Toby Jones of Rutgers University. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. War planes from the Saudi-led coalition struck the Yemeni cities of Aden and Ibb early today, despite a previous claim by Riyadh that it had ended its nearly month-long operation. Saudi officials said Wednesday they'll limit their military role in Yemen but continue to respond to Houthi attacks, they say. Human Rights Watch, meanwhile, reports Saudi Arabia appears to have deliberately bombed a humanitarian aid warehouse run by Oxfam that contains supplies to facilitate access to clean water for thousands of families. The International Committee of the Red Cross has warned the humanitarian situation in Yemen is catastrophic. We'll have more on Yemen later in the broadcast. In the European country of Malta, 24 unidentified migrants who died in the worst migrant boat disaster in the Mediterranean have been laid to rest. As many as 850 people drowned after their boat capsized while headed to Europe from Libya. In Britain, protesters climbed into body bags and laid on a beach to protest the migrant deaths. Carla McLaren of Amnesty International said European leaders need to take stronger action.
Today, Amnesty International is remembering the people who've lost their lives in the Mediterranean, and we're sending a really, really clear message to David Cameron and the other EU leaders that they need to act decisively and quickly in response to this crisis, and that means restarting search and rescue in the Mediterranean.
European leaders are gathering in Brussels today for an emergency meeting on the migrant crisis. A leaked draft of the summit statement obtained by The Guardian shows only 5,000 refugees would be offered the chance to resettle in Europe. At least 150,000 others would be deported. In Chile, thousands of people have been evacuated from a remote area in the south following the eruption of the Calbuco volcano. The volcano, which has lain dormant for over four decades, has now erupted twice in the span of hours. The initial eruption sent a spectacular plume of lava and ash shooting miles into the sky. Authorities in Japan are investigating the appearance of a drone containing possible radioactive material on the roof of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's office. Radioactive cesium was detected in the area after the drone was found carrying a bottle of liquid bearing the symbol for radioactivity. The drone's discovery came as a Japanese court approved the restart of a nuclear power station as part of Japanese Prime Minister Abe's push to return to nuclear power following the Fukushima meltdown in 2011. In the United States, Senate lawmakers are expected to approve Loretta Lynch as the first African-American woman attorney general today, after unanimously passing a human trafficking bill, which delayed her confirmation. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had refused to allow a vote on Lynch's nomination until the trafficking bill passed. For 6 weeks, the bill stalled as Democrats objected to a provision they say would have expanded the ban on taxpayer funding for abortion by applying it to non-taxpayer funds. The compromise still blocks abortion funding for victims, but does not extend the federal ban. Loretta Lynch has waited over 5 months for a confirmation vote, longer than any other cabinet nominee in the last three presidential administrations. She would replace outgoing Attorney General Eric Holder. Federal regulators appear poised to derail a planned merger between the nation's two largest cable providers, Time Warner and Comcast. The Wall Street Journal reports FCC staff have thrown up a significant roadblock to the deal by recommending a procedural move to place it in the hands of an administrative law judge. The cable firms may still have a chance to weigh in before the proceedings advance, but the process is expected to be lengthy and appears to signal the FCC opposes the merger. If it was allowed, the takeover would grant Comcast a virtual monopoly in 19 of the country's 20 top media markets. A Senate panel has passed a bill to grant President Obama authority to rush the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal through Congress. The TPP is currently being negotiated between the United States and 11 other Pacific Rim countries. The fast-track measure would allow Obama to present the agreement to Congress for a yes or no vote, with no amendments allowed. The Senate Finance Committee eventually approved the measure late Wednesday after a creative mover by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders delayed it. By applying an esoteric and rarely used scheduling rule, Sanders blocked the committee from taking up the measure until at least 4 p.m. He said he wanted to give the American people time to understand the TPP.
Not only is there massive opposition to this TPP agreement, but there is a lot of concern that the American people have not been involved in the process, that there's not a lot of transparency. So what we are trying to do here is to make sure that this debate takes place out in the public, that the American people have as much time as possible to understand the very significant implications of this trade agreement. And I suspect others, will do our best to make that happen.
A House panel is expected to consider fast-track legislation today. Senate Republicans have introduced a bill to extend the National Security Agency's bulk surveillance of call records, while bipartisan lawmakers have sought to reform the bulk spying program after it was exposed by Edward Snowden. The measure introduced late Tuesday by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Intelligence Committee Chair Richard Burr would fully reauthorize sections of the Patriot Act, which let the NSA vacuum up millions of Americans' phone records every day. The authority expires June 1st unless Congress takes action. In Baltimore, protests over the death of Freddie Gray have entered their fifth day. The 27-year-old African-American man died Sunday from spinal injuries 1 week after Baltimore police arrested him. A witness has said police bent Gray like a pretzel with a knee in the back of his neck. Six officers have been suspended in connection with his death. Only five have given testimony or made statements. We'll go to Baltimore for more after headlines. The family of Michael Brown, the 18-year-old African-American man whose fatal shooting by police officer Darren Wilson ignited the Black Lives Matter movement, are suing the city of Ferguson, Missouri. The family will announce their civil lawsuit today, accusing Ferguson of liability for Brown's wrongful death. Darren Wilson avoided both criminal and civil rights charges. In California, the local chapter of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union has vowed to shut down ports on May 1st in an historic protest against police brutality. In a statement, the union said, quote, "It's fitting that on May Day, International Workers' Day, Bay Area ports will be shut down to protest the racist police killing of mainly black and brown people." It's the first time a union has taken such an action. In 2008, the same union chapter shut down Pacific Coast ports to demand an end to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. A deputy U.S. marshal is facing an investigation after he was caught on video smashing the cell phone of a woman who is trying to film police activity. A bystander's video from the incident Sunday in Southgate, California, shows the marshal grabbing the cell phone out of Beatriz Paez's hand as she tries to film, then throwing it to the ground and kicking it. Paez displayed her smashed phone as she spoke to local ABC 7 News.
Threw everything on the ground and smashed it with his foot. He stomped on it and he kicked it.
The Clinton family's charities are refiling at least 5 annual tax returns after an investigation by Reuters found errors in how they reported donations from governments. Reuters found for 3 years in a row, beginning in 2010, the Clinton Foundation reported to the IRS that it received $0 in funds from governments. But several foreign governments actually continued to donate tens of millions of dollars to the foundation. Meanwhile, another report has raised questions about the Clinton Foundation's connection to the Russian takeover of a Canadian uranium mining firm. According to a New York Times report, based in part on a forthcoming book called Clinton Cash by Peter Schweitzer, the State Department, then led by Hillary Clinton, gave its approval to a deal which granted the Russians control of one-fifth of uranium production capacity in the United States. Amidst the takeover by the company, which became known as Uranium One, the Clinton Foundation received donations of over $2 million from the firm's chairman. A federal judge has approved a settlement to compensate National Football League players who suffer the impacts of repeated head injuries. The NFL estimates nearly a third of its players will suffer long-term cognitive problems like Alzheimer's. After 5,000 players sued the league, the NFL has agreed to pay up to $5 million to players who develop certain crippling neurological diseases. Critics say the settlement will exclude people whose conditions are not specifically covered. About 200 players have opted out. In South Carolina, a transgender teenager has won the right to wear makeup in her driver's license photo after suing the state's Department of Motor Vehicles. Chase Culpepper said DMV employees forced her to remove her makeup to, quote, look male for her initial picture. Under the terms of a settlement, the DMV will allow people to be photographed however they typically appear. Culpepper called the settlement a major victory for transgender rights.
I'm thrilled to be standing before you announcing this historic settlement with the South Carolina DMV. From day one, all that I wanted was to get a driver's license that looks like me. And now that I can finally have my photo taken with makeup, my new license will reflect that. I brought this case because what happened to me was wrong. It was hurtful to be singled out for being transgender.
Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal has vowed to fight for the passage of a law that critics say would allow discrimination against LGBT people by preventing the state from punishing companies based on their religious views of marriage. In an op-ed in the New York Times, Governor Jindal, who is expected to seek the Republican presidential nomination, condemned Indiana and Arkansas for caving to protests from businesses and softening their own so-called religious freedom measures. IBM has already opposed Louisiana's Marriage and Conscience Act. Governor Jindal wrote, companies are, quote, free to voice their opinions, but they will not deter me, he said. And here in New York, an environmentalist marked Earth Day Wednesday by swimming the Gowanus Canal, one of the most polluted waterways in North America. The Environmental Protection Agency has declared the canal a Superfund site, saying years of runoff, sewer outflows and discharge from industrial plants left it roiling with heavy metals, coal tar wastes and other contaminants. Christopher Swain spent nearly an hour swimming in the canal wearing a protective suit. He said his goal is to accelerate efforts to clean up the Gowanus Canal.
This is a no-joke, big, difficult cleanup. So what I'm here to say is, even though it's discouraging and even though it's difficult, let's find the courage to do it anyway, whatever it takes. I'm also saying let's define cleanup differently. Let's not clean it up part of the way. Let's not make it sort of not bad. Let's make it sparkle. Let's make it a diamond. Let's make it a jewel. Let's make the standard of clean safe enough to swim in every day.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We begin today's show in Baltimore, where protests over the death of Freddie Gray have entered their fifth day. The 27-year-old African-American man died Sunday from spinal injuries, 1 week after Baltimore police arrested him. His family and attorney say his voice box was crushed and his spine was, quote, 80% severed at his neck. A preliminary autopsy report showed Gray died of a spinal injury. Video shot by a bystander shows Gray screaming in apparent agony as police drag him to a van. You can hear a bystander's voice.
His leg looks broke. Look at his leg. Look at his leg. That boy's leg looks broke. His leg broke and y'all dragging him like that.
Another witness said the police bent Freddie Gray like a pretzel. Gray was then held inside a police van for 30 minutes. Police said, quote, during transport to Western District via wagon transport, the defendant suffered a medical emergency and was immediately transported to shock trauma via medic. The Department of Justice is now investigating Gray's death for possible civil rights violations. Since 2011, Baltimore has paid roughly $6.3 million to settle police misconduct claims. Baltimore authorities say five of the six officers involved in the arrest of Gray have now given statements to the Baltimore police. One has not. They remain suspended with pay. Baltimore Police Union attorney Michael Davey told reporters the officers were right to chase Gray, after he ran away when a lieutenant made eye contact with him.
They pursued Mr. Gray. They detained him for an investigative stop. Had he not had a knife or an illegal weapon on him, he would have been released. They know what role they played in the arrest of Mr. Gray. What we don't know and what we're hoping the investigation will tell us is what happened inside the back of the van. He was placed in the transport van. Whether he was seatbelted in, I don't believe he was. Our position is something happened in that van. We just don't know what.
Do you think any of the six officers committed a crime that day?
No.
Unequivocally, and what makes you say?
Based on the information that I know, no.
Well, on Wednesday, our next guest spoke with residents of the Gilmore Homes housing projects in West Baltimore, where Freddie Gray was arrested, including one woman who says she witnessed officers loading him into the back of a police van. In a minute, we'll be joined by our guest, Eddie Conway of the Real News Network. But first, this is a clip of his interview.
How you doing? I'm Eddie Conway.
I'm Famika.
Okay.
And I'm Jacqueline Jackson. I've seen it.
Yeah.
I live 1628 Mountmore Court. My kitchen faces Mount Street.
Okay.
The paddy wagon was right there. They took the young man out, beat him some more. The man wasn't responding. They took him by his pants, and he was dragging. Mm-hmm. And I asked them to call the ambulance. They told me to mind my business. Mm-hmm. I told them it is my business.
Mm-hmm.
And they just threw him up in there. The boy wasn't hollering or nothing. And mm-hmm. He wasn't hollering or nothing. How can you holler if you ain't saying nothing?
Mm-hmm.
They killed that young man. They killed him.
Eddie Conway of the Real News Network interviewing residents of the Gilmore Homes housing project where Freddie Gray was arrested. He was there last night when protesters called for justice in his case, marched again. And he joins us now in Baltimore. Eddie Conway is executive producer of the Real News Network, also a former Black Panther leader in Baltimore, Maryland, who was released from prison last year after serving 44 years for a murder he denies committing. We spoke to him last March, just 24 hours after he was released. We're also joined by Dominique Stevenson, who was arrested at last night's protest in Baltimore over the death of Freddie Gray. She's program director for the American Friends Service Committee's Friend of a Friend program, which fosters the peaceful resolution of conflict and promotes reconciliation and healing inside Maryland's criminal justice system. She's also co-author of Eddie Conway's memoir, Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. Dominique, let's begin with you. Can you explain why you were protesting yesterday and how you got arrested?
Well, I was protesting because there's a history in Baltimore of not so much police shootings, but people being beaten to death by the police. There's a long history. I feel that I needed to be there with the community. We had for some time been doing work in Gilmore Homes Housing Project, and I wanted to, you know, be there to stand in solidarity with the community. I was arrested because at some point a young woman, Michaela Price, decided to commit civil disobedience. She's 17 years old. I, one, did not want or even trust her being in police custody alone, and so I came over the barrier to accompany her.
Dominique, the state of Maryland also has the highest—Baltimore has the highest rate of incarceration in the state of Maryland. Could you connect that to the action that you took and to what happened to Freddie Gray?
Yes. One, if you look at statistics, that particular neighborhood, Sandtown Winchester is the neighborhood in Baltimore, has actually the highest incarceration rate in the state. And you cannot disconnect that rate of incarceration from the style of aggressive policing that takes place. We've talked to many young men. Okay, of course, there's crime in that community. There are no jobs in that community. There's no economic development happening in that community. But the other issue is the harassment of police, the unnecessary detainment of police. People don't know what Freddie Gray's history may have been with those folks that he saw and why making eye contact simply made him run. And so I think that we really need to take a look at how policing is done in Baltimore. And it cannot be disconnected from our high incarceration rate. Black folks make up almost 80% of the total population in the Maryland prison system, yet we comprise about 28% of the population in the state.
Eddie Conway, you were interviewing people in the area. We just saw you talking to a witness. This issue of there being video of Freddie Gray in the takedown when they are dragging him over to the or trying to carry him over to the police van, it looks like he cannot move. Yesterday, the police union spokesperson, attorney, said, oh, you know, that's what these perps do. They have to be dragged because they won't walk. Can you respond to this based on what you heard from witnesses?
Yes, from—and I interviewed perhaps 30 people from that community that was in that area or either heard the incident or witnessed the incident. The incident actually occurred under one of the police cameras that has been operating for years in that community, and they have been using that camera to make numerous drug arrests over the years. And for some reason, that day, that camera did not work. It would have been directly over Freddie Gray's head. It would have recorded everything that took place. One of the things that people say that one of the police dropped down on his back, on his neck with his knee. And from that point on, he was incapacitated. And later, they even took him back out of the van and shackled his legs and did something else to him and threw him back in the van. So as far as all the witnesses can tell, and all of them report that he was already fatally injured when they put him in the first place. That video that we saw with them dragging him to the van, he was already incapacitated.
And has anyone, Eddie Conway, given an explanation for why that camera didn't work that day?
No one knows why that camera didn't work. Everybody in the community says that that camera has been used consistently over the years to lock people up. And used for evidence in drug arrests and in other arrests. One of the things is, and I guess I want to raise this issue, when is it a crime for a man to run somewhere? People run throughout the city all the time. People are constantly running. So you get executed because you run?
No. Can you clarify, for people who haven't been following this case, the police union attorney yesterday said in a high-crime area, yes, you can arrest someone if they simply run. And no one alleges anything other than that Freddie Gray ran. What about this?
Well, it's not a high-crime area. It's a Broken Windows police area in which people and residents in that area are arrested for sitting on their own steps. they are laundering in their own community, on their own steps, and they're harassed constantly. And this have been the reports that I have received. The Real News and myself and friend of a friend, we have been going down in that area trying to establish a relationship with the people in that area. And one of the things that they said is that they're not even allowed to set out in the area on their steps, even though they live there, with the police will come and harass them. That level of harassment causes verbal responses. It causes physical contact. It causes people to be arrested. And before you know it, they have an arrest record, even as I'm talking 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old juveniles, and they end up in the prison system, and that's why that becomes the high crime system, the high crime area.
A statement from the Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge 3, Baltimore's police union, compared the protesters calling for justice in the death of Freddie Gray to a lynch mob. During a news conference Wednesday, reporters questioned the union's president about the comparison.
I just was reading the statement you all just handed out to us just now, and just reading it, the tone, I mean, it says that the images on TV look and sound much like a lynch mob. Are you, I mean, what are you having?
I haven't seen that.
Because they've already tried and convicted the officers, and that's just unfair. They still get their day in court. They did not give up their constitutional rights when they became a law enforcement officer. That's what I was getting at. To that, some of the protesters and some of the stuff I've been watching on the news, they want them put in prison. Well, they have been charged. Number one, number two, they still get their day in court. So how can they request that they be put in jail? We haven't even got to that process yet. The investigation has to be completed before we move forward.
Right, but are you concerned with the tone of the statement at all?
No, because I was quite offended by some of the things that were being said yesterday. Me personally, that's coming from me. That didn't come from Mike in the law firm.
This says it comes from the Fraternal Order of
yes,
Police.
Yes, that's so. I'm the president.
So, are you likening these citizens protesting in this rally to a lynch mob, specifically?
No. Well, let's put it this way: if they're tried, convicted, and they would have put them in jail, where's the due process with that?
That's Gene Ryan, the police union president. Dominique Stevenson, this likening to a lynch mob. Yesterday, you did get arrested. You went over the barrier. What is your reaction to the police union president?
Well, actually, if you take a look at what happened to Freddie Gray, he was tried, convicted, and executed. And so I resent likening people who are simply protesting and demonstrating and responding to a situation that was extremely unjust in their community to a lynch mob. As a person of African descent and understanding the history of lynching in this country, I find that statement offensive. I think that people are very frustrated because this is not the first time that this situation has occurred in Baltimore. I think that people have spent years of seeing these situations occur. People have experienced police brutality on so many levels, whether it's witnessing the mistreatment of loved ones or community members or experiencing it firsthand. There were so many people in the community yesterday who were willing to come up and talk about their experiences with the police, that this is something that has been so harmful to Black communities across the country, but particularly here in Baltimore. So I think that it is basically it's a statement designed to garner attention and to garner a response. I think that people have a right to protest. They should continue to do that. But along with that, we need to really begin to organize. We need to take control of how policing is done in our communities. And that will begin to resolve some of the problems.
Dominique Stevenson, we want to thank you for being with us. Eddie, I'd like to ask you to wait for one moment because you'll be staying with us. Eddie Conway, okay. With the Baltimore-based Real News Network. We are also going to be joined by the former president of the Baltimore City Council. This is Democracy Now! Major protest plan for today in Baltimore over the death of Freddie Gray. He was taken down by police on April April 12th. He died on April 19th. His family and lawyers say 80% of his that 80% of his spine was severed. Stay with us. Nina Simone. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our guests are, well, Eddie Conway is continuing with us right now. Eddie Conway is an executive producer for the Real News Network, former prisoner. He was imprisoned for more than 40 years. Lawrence Bell is also with us now, former president of the Baltimore City Council. He represents West Baltimore, which is the area where Freddie Gray was arrested. So we're going through the facts as we know them. On April 12th, Freddie Gray was arrested by police. It is not clear why. His family, his attorney said he was arrested for running while black. No one contends anything other than he was running, and they arrested him. They then drag him into the police van. The police union attorney said that could be because he was resisting. What the witnesses around him are saying is that he looked like he could not move. He could not use his legs, and he was yelling. He is put into this van at least 30 or was it 40 minutes before any kind of medical or medics were called. He would be in the hospital for a week. He died on April 19th, last Sunday. Five of the six police who were involved have given statements. One has refused to. They've all been put on leave with pay. Lawrence Bell, how typical is this? What are you most concerned about right now as the former president of the Baltimore City Council?
Well, first of all, I want to say it's good to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this subject. Unfortunately, Baltimore has had a long history, a very long history of these kinds of incidents going on. I think really what's changed here in Baltimore, as well as around the country, is that we live in an age where there's technology and people have cell phone, smartphones where they have cameras. Years ago, I remember over 20 years ago, I was one of the people that led the struggle to try to get civilian review. Strong civilian review here in the city of Baltimore, and that's something that has been resisted for many, many years. And I think it's because that there has been a camaraderie within the police department, kind of a stop-snitching mentality among police.
Misconduct settlements involving Baltimore police officers have cost the city more than $6 million since 2011. One victim, Barbara Floyd, told the Baltimore Sun that a detective ground her face into the concrete in 2009.
I stood by the tree outside of my door with my back facing the street. All of a sudden, I feel arms around my neck. So I was struggling because I didn't know who it was. Yeah, I was screaming when I could. Get off of me. Leave me alone. Why are y'all doing this? They never answer my questions. They don't answer your questions. All they do is tell you to shut the hell up.
In March 2009, Barbara Floyd was watching a disturbance outside her home when, she said, a police officer grabbed her.
He put another leg in the small of my back. He was grinding my face into the pavement. He kept telling me to lay down. I was already down.
That was Barbara Floyd. She received a settlement for $30,000. So you're the former president of the Baltimore City Council, Lawrence Bell. More than $6 million for police misconduct over the last few years. Now, you weren't president during that time, but can you talk about this?
Yeah, I mean, this has been going on for a number of years. And what's interesting is that the problem in Baltimore, I believe, became exacerbated in the early 2000s when former mayor Martin O'Malley began the zero tolerance policy. And what happened is that basically, you know, they've been arresting people for petty nuisance crimes, petty things, more arrests. And there's been a devaluation of black life. And so these things have happened. Now, one thing to note is that many of the settlements back over the several years occurred outside of the public meeting setting at the Board of Estimates in Baltimore. So you didn't have a great groundswell of talk about it because a lot of it wasn't really out in the public view as it is today. But this has been going on for a while, and I think that it just speaks to the need for change. We need civilian review. We need a different attitude within the police department. We need a better attitude in the whole city. And I think, as I said earlier, we need to have jobs in these communities. You know, something that's concerned me is that not only in Baltimore, but around the country, even among a lot of the black leaders, we've heard them talk about the issue of police misconduct, but we haven't talked about the ways that black lives are minimized when we are economically depressed and more money has gone into prisons, building prisons, that has gone into jobs in places like Sandtown and Baltimore.
And Lawrence Bell, what is your response to the way that the mayor has responded to what's happened? Both the mayor and the police commissioner in Baltimore are African-American, and some have pointed out that this means their response has been much better than what it was, for example, in Ferguson after what happened with Michael Brown.
Well, I think the mayor is sincere. I think that there's still a problem with a lot of leadership, even black leadership, being out of touch with the people on the ground. You know, there's an emotion that people feel, and that has to be recognized. And I think the mayor and the commissioner, number one, they need to move a lot faster. I mean, we know that there were a certain number of people on the scene when this incident occurred. It shouldn't take rocket science to determine that something went wrong. And we need answers a lot faster, a lot quicker. And the length of time that this is taking is a thing that's really inflaming the passions of the people in the community. So I think that the mayor should do a lot more, a lot faster. I think that, again, as I said earlier, some years ago, there was a video in Baltimore called Stop Snitching. And they talk about people in the drug arena snitching on one another. But here's the thing. Police apparently have a mentality of stop snitching among themselves, not only in Baltimore, but around the country. And that's what people are upset about, the whole idea that there's cover-up and that we know that these kinds of things have happened for years. And I think if you interview some police officers who are honest, maybe people who are retired, they'll tell you that this goes on all the time. So we need to have a whole change. We also need to recruit more African-Americans onto the police force as well.
Billy Murphy, the attorney for the Gray family, says police brutality is a pervasive problem in Baltimore.
Fine. Baltimore
Absolutely.
Has a sorry history of police brutality and an even sorrier history in terms of a governmental response to police brutality. Mm-hmm. Typically, the police deny, no matter what the facts are. And it is not unusual for them to promote the police officer even after he's been found guilty of brutality. We had one case, I handled this, where we got a $44 million verdict against a police officer who rammed my client into the brick wall at the back of his holding cell and paralyzed him from the neck down.
Oh, my goodness.
That police officer was promoted to sergeant after the verdict against him. And the city refused to pay and made us appeal at every level. Mm. So we had to go to the Court of Special Appeals, the Court of Appeals. We won in all of the appellate courts, and still they wouldn't pay the verdict. Well, so it's a sorry situation.
Family attorney Billy Murphy speaking on CNN. On Tuesday, Michigan Democratic Congressmember John Conyers reintroduced a bill to curb racial profiling and provide relief to profiling victims. Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland introduced a companion bill in the Senate. During a news conference, Congressman Conyers cited the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore.
All lives matter. All lives matter. And I'm thinking now of Sean Bell, Kimani Gray, Oscar Grant, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, Walter Scott, and now, sadly, Freddie Gray. And so all of these African-American young men were killed at the hands of local police officers. Ultimately, they are tragic examples of the risk of racial profiling and the use of excessive force.
So that's Congressmember John Conyers after reintroducing a bill against racial profiling. Lawrence Bell, would you call stopping a man while he's running is racial profiling? Again, the police union attorney said yesterday in the news conference that if they're running in a high-crime area, that's cause enough. Now, I was just watching on television Leonard Hamm, the former police chief of Baltimore, being interviewed, and he said no. He was the former police chief. He said no, running is not enough. Lawrence Bell, your thoughts?
Well, I think these people need to study the law, because there is a concept of probable cause that exists. And I think it's absurd to say that somebody simply running after they make eye contact with a police officer is probable cause. So it makes you wonder, really, you know, where are these people being trained and where do they get this mentality? And I'll tell you something, quite honestly, there's a question of how they perceive black men. The perception of black men and the value of black men is on display right now when we see these kinds of incidences go on. So I think that that's something we need to deal with right away.
And Eddie Conway, we'd like to get your comments on the clip that we played earlier of the police union president, Gene Ryan, likening the protesters to a lynch mob. Could you comment on that?
You know, as a journalist and a reporter, I have to question the language. I mean, a lynching did occur. Freddie Gray was lynched. There was a lynch mob. There is a body. There was a death without a trial, without a jury, without a sentence. There was an execution. That's lynching. So for anybody to say that people that exercise their First Amendment rights to protest, to demand justice, to demand an investigation is a lynch mob, it's 1984. It's doublespeak. They're blaming the victims. They're blaming people that suffered the lynching for protesting about the lynching, about their behavior. And I think that is, I mean, they do not serve and protect the citizens of the community, the people that pay them, when they kill those citizens and then in turn accuse those citizens of acting out of order and arresting those citizens for protesting the violence that they inflict upon the citizens. That's absurd.
There is a big difference in the way North Charleston, South Carolina, dealt with the killing of Walter Scott and what's happening today. A police officer was arrested. The mayor and the police chief went to see the family of the Scotts to give their condolences. Now, I understand the Baltimore mayor did call the family to visit them, and they said it wasn't the time to do that. But on the issue, and I wanted to put this question to Lawrence Bell, of these six police officers, they have all been suspended with pay. Five have given statements. One has not. There's been very little information released. There's an internal investigation. There's a Justice Department investigation. There are a few others, apparently. What do you feel—and I'll put this question to both of you—needs to be done now? Apparently, the state will be releasing Freddie Gray's body soon.
Well, there needs to be some finality in terms of the investigation. It has to happen a lot faster. We do—you know, we even have doctors here at Johns Hopkins University have already said that the kind of injury that Mr. Gray suffered had to occur from it had to be a very strong contact that he had with somebody, it seems to say. And so, you know, we're not rocket scientists. We don't need to study this forever to come up with certain conclusions. We need to have the statements that were made by the police officers released. We need to know everything that happened right away. We need speed here. We need to know what has happened, and we need to have some people charged. And I tell you, when you have people who are suspended but they're still getting paid, that's the kind of thing that really inflames the passions of the people. And they feel that there's a two-tier justice system. There's one for police. There's a different one for just regular citizens.
And finally,
yeah, I would add that. If any other citizen or any other six citizens had been involved in the death of another citizen, they would all be in central booking. They would all be up for bail hearings. They would all be at least investigated in that kind of manner. They wouldn't be receiving paid vacation. So there's a double standard here in terms of the lives of citizens.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to follow this. More than 1,000 people are expected in protests today in Baltimore. Eddie Conway, executive producer of the Real News Network, a former prisoner for more than 40 years. Lawrence Bell, former Baltimore City Council president, represented West Baltimore, which is an area where Freddie Gray was arrested. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about Saudi Arabia bombing Yemen. Red Cross is calling it a catastrophe. Stay with us.
For the free people in the world, your right shoulder. Throw your fist in the sky if you feel it. Your left shoulder. Tap. Company. Ain't about your guns on with hellfire. Spitting. Burn up everything they hitting. Some do their job to dodge the barrage that sleep projectiles. Devastate miles. Firefight invasion night with light. Loud. Plane shower shell rain, hit a shot and kill crops on the terrain, and leave any grain that may remain shame. You goddamn right, this war gone too far. Soldiers mistake the gun first for the stars. Wartime, I find a beauty in the star. High level with death, even beneath great dawn. High level with death, even beneath great dawn. High level with death, and she got pretty eyes. Nobody told me that was so damn fine. I go to sleep with that girl on my mind. Wake up and I see her on the firing line. I grab my heat. And it's get down time. One day I'ma make that ground all mine. But for now, I'm a soldier. Find my time. Where I'ma rhyme a high enemy line. Put a sign on the road, catch me.
War by Yasin Bey here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
War planes from the Saudi-led coalition struck the Yemeni cities of Aden and Ibb early today, despite a claim by Riyadh that it had ended the military operation known as Decisive Storm. Saudi Arabia and 9 Arab allies began bombing Yemen on March 25th. The United States provided intelligence and logistical support for the attacks and accelerated the sale of new weapons to its Gulf allies. Earlier this week, the United States deployed 2 additional warships off the coast of Yemen. The bombing began after Houthi rebels seized control of the capital Sana'a last year and deposed President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. On Wednesday, the International Committee of the Red Cross said the humanitarian situation in Yemen is catastrophic. Following a brief visit to Yemen, the regional director of the ICRC, Robert Mardini, told reporters the collateral damage wrought on civilian life was absolutely shocking.
The conflict in Yemen is in dire need for a political solution. We encourage that to happen. But in the meantime, the humanitarian situation is worsening by the day, and in certain locations is really catastrophic. We urge all the parties to take every precaution to protect women, men, and children. We call on them once again to facilitate desperately needed impartial humanitarian action.
Human Rights Watch has said it appears Saudi Arabia may have deliberately bombed a humanitarian aid warehouse run by Oxfam that contains supplies to facilitate access to clean water for thousands of families in Sada'a. Oxfam said it had given the coalition forces the building's exact coordinates to keep it from being targeted. Human Rights Watch said, quote, serious violations of laws of war committed with criminal intent, that is, are deliberate or reckless, are war crimes. On Wednesday, Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S. said his country had achieved its mission in Yemen. This is Adel Al-Jubeir.
We destroyed their air force. We destroyed their ballistic missiles, as far as we know. We destroyed their command and control. We destroyed much, if not most, of their heavy equipment. And we made it very difficult for them to move from a strategic perspective. So we've degraded their capabilities substantially and thereby eliminated the threat that they posed to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and in the process ensured the safety of our borders, our territory, and our citizens. That was the objective of Operation Decisive Storm, in addition, of course, to the protection of the legitimate government of Yemen. Those objectives have been achieved.
We're joined now by Toby Jones, Associate Professor of History and Director of Middle East Studies at Rutgers University, author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forge Modern Saudi Arabia. Jones was previously the International Crisis Group's political analyst of the Persian Gulf. So let's start with Operation Decisive Storm. Obviously sounds just like Operation Desert Storm. Toby Jones, can you talk about what Saudi Arabia is doing right now in Yemen with U.S. support?
Well, Adel Jubeir said it very well, right? The Saudis are interested in destroying and degrading Yemen's military capacity, particularly those of the Houthis. But they have a series of mixed objectives that we shouldn't be persuaded by. One is the stated claim that they want to protect their borders and any threat to Saudi Arabia. The reality is the Houthis have never represented a threat to Saudi Arabia, and they still don't, even though they enjoy control over much of Yemen. And the other is to restore the legitimate government of President Hadi. In reality, Hadi was his position in power was orchestrated by the Saudi and the GCC after the Arab uprisings. I mean, the bottom line is this. Yemen has long been the backyard of Saudi Arabia. It's a deeply impoverished place that the Saudis believe they should assert political authority in, that they should influence outcomes. The fact that they've been challenged on their southern border is troubling, but it's also because Yemen is fairly easy for them to intervene in. We've seen no resistance in the region. This is something that the Saudis can carry out with very little punishment or accountability and carry on and declare it into it when they like. The reality on the ground is that they've accomplished very little. The Houthis have retained political authority. They're even operating in Aden, on which the Saudis said they hope to preempt. It's not clear what they've accomplished. They've declared victory, but they've done little more than actually kill almost 1,000 Yemenis and degrade what was already a troubled infrastructure and environment.
Well, the Saudis say that they've now changed. The new phase of operations is called Renewal of Hope. Toby Jones, could you respond to the repeated claims by the Saudis and others that the Iranians are supporting the Houthis and that's what's forced Saudi Arabia to intervene in this way?
Well, there's no clear coordination between Iran and the Houthis. Let's be clear. There's absolutely no evidence that Iran is operating on the ground in Yemen or that it's directing orders to the Houthi rebels. The Saudis have done a masterful job in the last month, and even before that, dating back to last fall when the Houthis began their march out of northern Yemen toward the south, in repackaging what the Houthis are up to as part of a regional sectarian problem. But the reality is that Yemen has been a deeply fractured place for quite a long time, and the Houthis have asserted and demanded their right to be equal participants in a federal political order. They've been historically marginalized. The Saudis have ignored all of this and have sort of pushed through a narrative that suggests that something more nefarious, conspiratorial, and regional is at work. And I think we can measure Saudi Arabia's political and military intervention in terms of success and failure. They've accomplished very little on the ground other than to break things. But the fact that they've helped frame and convince the Western media, Western policymakers, and many folks who might be casual observers that the Houthis are Iranian agents is a form of success, even though it's not true.
I want to turn to a clip from Tuesday's State Department briefing. A reporter asked Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf for evidence that Iran is supporting the Houthis.
White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said the administration has evidence that Iranians are supplying weapons and other support,
Correct.
Form of support to Houthis. What kind of evidence does the administration have? Can you update us?
Well, this isn't something new, unfortunately. We've long talked about the support when it comes from funding or whether it's weapons supplies that the Iranians are sending to the Houthi. This has been really an ongoing relationship for a very long time. I'm happy to see if there's more evidence to share publicly of that, but this has been something we've expressed concern about for some time.
Toby Jones, can you respond to the State Department on this point and also talk about the role of the U.S. right now?
Well, I wouldn't be at all surprised that there are Iranian weapons circulating amongst the Houthis, right? I mean, the Iranians are opportunists. I mean, we don't want to whitewash Tehran's interest or objective in asserting its own hegemony in the region. I mean, it's involved in all kinds of places. But this is rather thin grounds on which to claim that there's some widespread cooperation or coordination between Tehran and what's going on in North Yemen, right? I mean, if we want to make the claim that rebels or militants operating with one country's weapons across the Middle East is a sign of coordination, then what do we make of Al-Qaeda and ISIS using American weapons captured in the battlefield or having been supplied by Saudi Arabia and others in Syria and Iraq and Yemen? And this is a dubious claim that obscures more than it clarifies. As far as the American role goes, and the Americans view Yemen as a Saudi backyard, and they're going to defer to the Saudis here. I mean, there's lots of geopolitical sort of moving parts here as well. While the Americans are chipping away on a nuclear arrangement with Iran, they understand and they're very clear that the Saudis are uncomfortable with all of that. So they're making concessions on Yemen because it's easy for the Americans to do so, providing small-scale cover and other kinds of material support, including putting warships close by the port of Aden and elsewhere. I mean, this is simply a matter of the Americans making choices about where they can support the Saudis and where they can oppose them elsewhere, or at least where they can work at odds with them. Yemen is and has for a long time been the most deeply impoverished place in the Middle East. But it has also been a political football in the region that the Saudis and the Americans have kicked around. This is a place where we talk about catastrophe and the environmental and humanitarian consequences of the recent campaign. This is not new in Yemen. Very little has been done to address it. And in spite of all of that, the U.S. has almost always pursued Yemen as a place to drop bombs and to target what they call militants. And with that in mind, it's easy for them to support the Saudis, who are claiming to do the same thing.
The significance of the Houthis now calling for negotiation. What do you think needs to happen, Toby Jones?
Well, I think the Houthis have long called for a political settlement and negotiation. We think back to late last summer when they began moving out of the north and into the south, when they converged on Sana'a and pushed Hadi out of office. The Houthis were calling for, a bigger negotiating table, a greater presence, real accommodation for various political demands from around the country. The Houthis aren't the only ones who have put pressure on Sana'a's old central government. Pressure has come from the south. It's come from tribal confederations, all of whom have suggested that the political dialogue and the national discussion about the post-Arab uprising political rapprochement that was necessary had been a deeply flawed process. The Houthis didn't call for war. They coordinated closely with actors on the ground. They're the ones who are being attacked, even though they're the ones who have been calling for a political settlement to a deeply broken system all along. That the fact that the Saudis have recast this in a language that the Houthis are the villains and the ones acting dangerously is remarkable, as is the fact that the Saudis can drop bombs while calling it a humanitarian mission. In reality, I mean, in many ways, it's a play straight from the American playbook.
And the Red Cross is calling it a humanitarian catastrophe. 10 seconds, Toby.
Well, it is a humanitarian catastrophe. But Yemen was already in a state of humanitarian catastrophe, with hundreds of thousands being internally displaced. This is a place that has rapidly run out of water. It has very little in the way of natural resources. The Saudis are just making a bad situation worse.
Toby Jones, we want to thank you for being with us, Associate Professor of History and Director of Middle Eastern Studies at Rutgers University, author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forge Modern Saudi Arabia. Previously worked with the International Crisis Group's political analyst of the Persian Gulf. That does it for our broadcast. I'll be speaking tonight in Colorado Springs, Colorado, at 7 p.m. at Celeste Hall inside the Cornerstone Arts Center. So check our website at democracynow.org. And all Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, we'll be broadcasting from The Hague. It's the 100th anniversary of one of the oldest women's peace organizations in the world, the International Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Aaron Mate, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkafani, Masood, Ravi Karandina, Gezder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy